This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 72 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. In today's episode, we have the priestess. Here's your hosts, Lee and Chrissy.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Kinky Cast. And tonight, we have Chrissy sitting across the console from me. I'm Lee, and Woody and the Beast are out of the room tonight. It is a women's only show. Take it away, Chrissy.
Hello, Lee. Thank you for that introduction. We have a special guest today. Many people may know her as Priestess, and she is a priestess. And she's going to take some time this evening to discuss sacred kink with us. And that seems to be a topic that people talk about and no one really seems to understand. What is it? But let's start off with you, Miss Priestess. May I call you Priestess?
Please call me Priestess.
That's great. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I was looking over some information about you, and you are very diverse in your interests and very diverse as far as the different activities that you engage in. It's really amazing to me to see how diverse your background is, and you just touch so many different things. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your background?
I would, and I have to say, I must be channeling Groucho Marx or something, because when you said how diverse my background is, I kind of want to say, but you should see my foreground.
And it's lovely.
Well, you can show it anytime you like.
But yeah, you know, it all weaves together really for me in the sacred and in, you know, when we think of a word like holy, holy has the same etymological root as healthy, as whole, as healing. And for me, what really is my turn on is how do we live our lives in a way that reclaims our authenticity, that releases shame, that has us feel more joy in being alive, more passion and clarity about, you know, who we are and why we're here and what our life purpose is. It all weaves together. I've studied shamanism and psychology, kink and sacred kink and therapeutic kink, clinical sexology, somatic sex therapy, drama therapy, myth and history. It all weaves together for me in pulling together techniques, pieces of information that support our vibrancy, support our wholeness. You could say support our pleasure and our joy today.
You mentioned a lot of different type of therapies, a lot of different avenues to heal. So you consider yourself a healer too. Is that part of your makeup?
Yes. My makeup is multicolored.
Yes, it is, as it should be.
I do think of that as part of my makeup, as part of who I am, in a particular way, because I believe that we cannot really heal or save, fix, or change another person. You know, it's not my job to do that for another human being. But I can collaborate. I can partner with another person to the extent that they would like that, to the extent that there's consent, to the extent that they're able to work with me in that way. So we collaborate with one another, and at the same time, we can't really save one another. So when I think of healer, I think of collaborator.
I can understand what you mean when you say that a person is working in a collaboration or a partnership to heal that. I don't think anyone could do it by themselves, or maybe a few people could actually do that. But I think when you're working in tandem with someone else, it's much more helpful to have someone help you move through the rough spots and soothe you and nurture you and even guide you and hold up a hand when you stumble. So I think that's a good thing. We're talking today about sacred kink, and that's not the same as sacred sexuality in my mind. What would you use as your definition of sacred kink?
I would say sacred kink and sacred sexuality are at least kissing cousins.
Yes, I think so, but they're not the same.
Perhaps sacred sexuality might be the bigger framework, where if we think that sex is, at its core, is energy exchange. It's when we start to interact with one another with the intent of arousal, with the intent of heightening our arousal or connecting our arousal to another human being. And there's so many ways to do that. There's the tantric ways, and there are, you know, breathing together, looking into each other's eyes, and we could be laying down next to each other and really breathing together then, or feeling this energy connection between ourselves, laying side by side. Or we could, you know, one of us could be tied up to a cross and the other one could be behind us with a flogger or with a whip, with a paddle, or with our hands. So I think that there's a lot of, almost an infinite number of ways to start to engage this sexual energy or this energy of arousal. What makes it sacred is when we start to bring our intention, when we start to recognize that energy follows intention. So literally what I think, what I intend starts to shift the way I feel, the way my partner, the person that I'm interacting with, feels. And it's a wonderful experiment that I'd encourage people to try sometime, is to have your partner blindfolded or have them close their eyes and think of a particular type of energy. You know, maybe it could be hungry energy, or maybe it could be angry energy, or maybe it could be loving energy, or maybe it could be healing energy. And think of a particular kind of energy, and then imagine that you're putting it into your hand, and then touch that person, or you could spank that person. And then take a moment and breathe and really tune into a different energy, touch them or spank them again, and pick a third. Really take that moment to switch gears, to switch feeling, to switch the energy that we would say you're channeling, and try again. And then ask the person who is receiving if they could tell a difference. It's a really intriguing experiment to do with people. And more often than not, people have felt a difference. They have their favorite flavors that they like and that they don't like. And we start to be our own scientists, our own experimenters around this thing called energy and the sacred or magic.
Let me interrupt just for a moment, just as a disclaimer, in case anybody gets any ideas. Do this with your partner's consent. I have to say that.
Talk about it first. Get consent.
Right.
Yeah, you can get consent that you can think of these energies. And they could actually give you three energies. You could either say, could I come up with three energies and then just have you guess? Or you could have them give you three energies to try, but they don't know which order you're trying in. And either way, it'll be a great experiment. And so we start to have energy follows intention is a basis for the sacred. And that when we think of sacred, like if I asked you what makes something sacred, what would you say?
Me personally, what makes something sacred?
Mm-hmm.
Sacred is something that has a particular relevancy, or something that I reserve for very special situations, something that I've poured a lot of my personal energy into that has great positive frequency for me. It's a very good thing for me. Those things are sacred. I have crystals that I consider sacred because they resonate with me. We're in harmony. I have items that people have given me that are sacred items, and they're only used very rarely with certain people. That's what I think of as sacred.
Beautiful.
I think my relationship with my partner is sacred. I think especially the DS part of it, because I've always felt that you give more of yourself in that particular kind of relationship, just because it's a power exchange. You know, I'm putting my body in your hands, and I know that you're going to take care of it. And to me, that trust that we have with each other is very sacred.
Beautiful. And when I've asked people all over the world, they've often said very similar things to what you're saying. They've said that sacred is a sense of special or precious, that sacredness often has a sense of focus or almost being set apart from the day-to-day in some way. And certainly when we're thinking of a committed DS relationship that has such a container, when we think of the collar, the contract, when we think of even the scene. There's such a sense of specialness, that preciousness, that focus, that within relationship, trust, a very sacred thing. We have this feeling, this quality, energy, and focus that makes something sacred. That can be brought to dominance and submission, the way that we flog someone, that could be brought to the way that we tie someone up, to the way that we have intercourse with someone, or the way that we caress them. And we feel it when someone is bringing us that level of attentiveness and also a focus, I think you said, a positive frequency, a sense of wanting the highest and best for both of us. And we also feel that. So when I think of, is sacred kink or sacred BDSM different than sacred sexuality? Well, it's different in maybe the what we're doing, that we're using the toys and tools and techniques of kink versus when we might identify as not kinky. I think the energy itself, the quality of focus, the quality of attentiveness is actually, you know, very similar.
We'll be right back after this message.
Make connections the day you arrive at Speed Networking. No need to act your age at our Littles pageant. Get really messy with us at the Splosh Party. Join us at Southeast Leatherfest, where we're erecting a vision.
Well, I'm erect, are you?
Oh, yeah.
Visit SDLeatherFest.com. Come to South June 11th through the 14th in Atlanta and erect your vision.
Yay! And welcome back, and we'll continue with the conversation
with Priestess, who you also may know as the lovely Francesca Gentile. Welcome back, Priestess.
Glad to be here.
Priestess, we were talking about sacred kink, and you were giving a fantastic explanation of how you're viewing it. You mentioned sacred kink and sacred BDSM. Those are some terms that I'm familiar with from listening to and also reading Lee Harrington's book. I know that you mentioned that as a tome that you read. And also, I'm thinking of some work by Radical Ecstasy by Dossie and Easton, and a book by Raven Caldera and Joshua Tenpenny. Have you read those?
I have read Radical Ecstasy. I have read The Eightfold Path, Lee Harrington's book. I actually have Raven Caldera's book and have not yet read it. Oops.
I understand my reading table is always piled high. It's difficult to find time, but I'm sure that you'll enjoy it when you get to it. It's something that I've read and recently had the pleasure of spending some time with Mr. Raven Caldera and Joshua, and that was quite an interesting time, but that's a whole nother topic. Let's go back to sacred kink and sacred BDSM. I'm finding that your insights are marvelous. Would you care to expand a little bit more on what we were talking about?
Certainly. When I think of sacred kink, I actually feel that it's our birthright, that we've been doing this as human beings probably as long as there's been human beings that have been engaging in ritual. There's evidence of some of the first shamanism going back 20 or 30,000 years. And I personally believe that we were using the tools and techniques of kink at that time. We were using things like, you know, the surprise or the ordeal or the challenge that would potentially push someone through an initiation or challenge them through an initiation. We were using those intense sensations, whether that was to really guide someone into a deeper trance state or a vision quest, similar to the Native American sun dance where they pierce their pectorals and they dance for vision quest. And this has been in going on for thousands of years. And we have in Bali, they take that wavy knife and they also pierce their chests. And it's called a kris, K-R-I-S. And so this is, you know, when I think of BDSM, it's, I think in a way, the playful nature of BDSM is what's new. The sacred nature of BDSM has been going on forever.
I agree with you. It's all across the world in all cultures in some aspect. Different names, same techniques.
I was raised Catholic, and we have in more ancient Catholicism, they have the self-flagellation.
Right.
And the hair shirts.
The hair shirts?
The hair shirts, yeah.
What is that?
It was made out of, it might have been human hair, it might have been wool hair, but it was done in a way that would be extremely uncomfortable. So what we had to do was to be able to go into an altered state.
Gotcha.
So that we could not itch and not scratch and not just, you know, take it off our bodies. Mm-hmm. So when we're in these extreme states of discomfort, our mind is challenged to do something with that, to either go into a vision quest or a flight, to go into some deep form of meditation or trance. Some people, you know, can even turn some of that sensation into something that feels more pleasurable. But we have to do something mm-hmm. when we're challenged that way. And I think that's what we're pointing to has really been in all cultures throughout time when we're looking at the spiritual path or the religious path or the mystical path.
Sort of a doorway to open to a little bit of an altered conscious state using the push of the ordeal or the push of the kink or the push of the bondage or whatever it might be at that time. Do you think that there's an increase of people exploring this now?
I do. I feel that, you know, in some of my reading and research, that when the Catholic Church really consolidated its power, it started to make a very dark bargain with the medical profession. It ended up murdering thousands, they say up to millions, of men and women who were the, you know, the herbologists and who were the wise women and wise men and who were the priests or priestesses or the shamans, actually, you know, killing them. And in that dark time, medicine was allowed to work, it was allowed to function only with the body. The blood, the bones, the nerves, and anything that had to do with emotion, anything that had to do with energy, anything that had to do with spirit belonged to the Catholic Church. So after 300 years of the Inquisition, we end up seeing something like, you know, the Marquis de Sade at that point is saying, well, we're going to take these techniques and we're going to have fun with them because we're not doing spirituality. You know, if the church is maybe self-flagellating or the church is doing these other things in a spiritual way, we're going to do them in a fun way. And I think there's been a lot of that almost rebelling against the restriction of the Christian churches. But today, in our world today, where we have such an opportunity to explore religion from every culture and from every time period, where we can really pick and choose and form our own religion and our own spirituality. We can say, I want a little bit of the Hinduism, or I want a little bit of Buddhism, or I want a little bit of a certain type of Catholicism, or I want a little bit of, you know, Judaism, or I want to create my own personal pathway to the divine. I think people are now much more open to connecting back to the divine, because there's not as much separation, if that makes sense as a concept.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that people are much more open, and many people are always looking for that in some way, shape, or form. And the ability to use, you know, as you say, the cherry picking and to make what's right for them is, I think it's happening more and more. I read recently that there's, you know, a steady decline in the number of people that are members of the Catholic Church. And I don't know if that's correct, but I read that number somewhere that it was dropping. New people aren't coming to that church in particular. I don't know about any other religious organizations. I know many people that I'm very friendly with tend to be pagans, or they tend to be very eclectic in their, you know, preferred religious belief. As you said, cherry picking and finding what works best for them. And of course, many of my friends are also kinky, but I can also identify with the use of kink to increase my level of a higher frequency, a higher vibration, and being more open to communicate with the divine.
And I think as we talk about it, as we have these kinds of interviews, it continues to spread the concept. And when I first entered into the realms of the public scene in the San Francisco area, my partner at the time said, you know, the scene priestess is not ready for you. And I said, because I was already a shaman for over 20 years. And I said, you know, when I'm coming into the world of kink and BDSM, I want to bring the sacred. I want to have sacred scenes. I want to have ritual. This is what I really want. And my partner at the time said, you know, nobody's going to want that. Nobody talks about that. You know, it's not going to work. And I said, well, I'm going to start a munch. I'm going to call it the Kinky Spirituality Munch. And if I'm the only person sitting at the table, that's fine. But I'm going to start this munch. We started to have 16 people, 18 people. This little back room would be completely filled with people that wanted to talk about this. After a couple of years, I said I wanted to form a sacred kink temple. And, you know, people have come out for that and have loved it. And I was very bold. I would sit down, you know, go to a play party or at some dungeon. And if I started out as a slave, you know, if my master gave me permission to actually talk to people, I would be sitting down. And if somebody sat next to me, I would turn to them and I would say, I practice sacred kink. Do you? And very quickly, something would happen. Either people would start backing away.
Too much woo.
I'm going to walk away now. But so often, it was surprising how often they would actually lean closer and almost whisper into my ear and say, like it was a dirty secret, and say, I feel energy. I feel energy in the scene. Or I feel the energy move in the scene. Or I feel that there is something really sacred or spiritual happening in the scene. And like I said, at first, it was almost like this dirty secret that they were, you know, because we can sometimes take such pride in being rebels, you know, rebels and perverts at the edge of society, that it almost felt naughty in an extra naughty way. Now I'm spiritual with it. We're raising awareness that it's perfectly fine. You know, it's perfectly fine to have a scene or an encounter with someone that's the sole purpose is just maybe, you know, fun or, you know, sex or whatever the sole purpose is. And it's also perfectly okay to have a scene that is deeply moving and that brings us closer or lets us heal from trauma or lets us feel like we're in a trance. And I think I absolutely feel that subspace and top space, you know, dom space, are trance states.
I think you're probably right about that, depending on how far someone is willing to let themselves experience it, willing to go with the flow and embrace it. I agree. I know that I have had interesting experiences in subspace.
Do tell.
But I've had insights come to me. I've had deep, deep connections with people, just actually visualizing the energy flowing between us, is being able to see it, being able to move it as I wished to different areas of their body in mm-hmm. scene. I know that they picked it up because they returned it. I'm sure that can do a lot of things when you're in that state, if you're willing to open up and allow it to flow. Now, you mentioned a temple. Could you talk about the temple that you created?
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of a roving temple.
Okay.
The temple could come to your house.
Come on.
We don't have an actual building that we've purchased or consecrated. We haven't bought property. It's a group of people. Like all magic, like all sacred, it starts with our thoughts, our intentions, our descriptions. And I would say to those that are listening that if you wanted to start a sacred kink temple, create a FetLife profile, create a website, start to really vision what your intention is, what your purpose is for your temple. Is it a temple of kinky play? Is it a temple of kinky transformation? Is it a temple of sacred kink research? You know, what is your temple? And as you start to put it out to the world, to your community, people who resonate with it, people who agree with it, will start to show up. And our temple here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you're always welcome to come to join us, our temple meets about quarterly, every, you know, approximately 3 months. And we like to rotate leadership so that there's new energy, new vision, new design. And we also like to rotate themes. So it's not always the same. We've done a community ritual where the purpose was to connect community. And every every person at this particular ritual had 3 or 4 minutes to step into the center of the room and design their own scene. And their scene could be, you know, being witnessed doing something to themselves. Their scene could be asking a couple people to join them in the center and do something with them or for them or to them. It could be including everyone in the circle. And each person, as they stood in the middle, was empowered to make that decision. And it was beautifully connective for everyone. We also did a ritual that was a kinky version of Inanna and Dumuzi and Dal. And for those who don't know, the story of Inanna and Dumuzi is from Sumeria, and it is our world's oldest known writing. It's in cuneiform, and it was written by a priestess and Hedwana. And we have evidence that shows that she was the daughter of the king at that time. This wonderful story includes sacred sexuality. It includes death and rebirth. It includes elements that could definitely be very kinky. So we put it towards the kinky side, and we had the god of wisdom, who is Enki. We had the god of wisdom be similar to like a leather daddy. And of course, Inanna, the goddess of heaven and earth, ends up wanting to go into the great below, the land of death and rebirth. And when she goes, she's challenged at 7 gates. In these 7 challenges, she's asked to remove articles of clothing. She's questioned, you could say interrogated. We added more kink elements into that. Then when she goes into that dark place, she meets her sister self, her shadow self, her mirror self, which we all have. We all have the part of ourselves that we know and talk about and the part of ourselves that we deny. She meets that, and that part of her kills her and hangs her on a meat hook to dry. And then eventually she's reclaimed and gets to return to the world above. But she's learned something. She's become something. She's become a stronger, wiser being. And all of the participants then had got to choose, did they wish to make an offering or a connection with that dark self? Did they want to in some way find their own dark self? Or they could choose to interact with Inanna and go deeper into their pleasure. Or they could interact with Enki, our leather daddy, in some way.
The leather daddy. I'm sorry. I'm just getting visual flashes of what that might be in Sumerian time. And I'm having trouble reconciling it in my mind. But
you know, it's really wonderful. You know, ultimately, we get to make this up as we go along.
That's the most fun.
The next ritual that our sacred kink temple, which is called the Temple of Shadows, is going to do is actually my collaring ceremony to the divine. So I can imagine you might want me to say more about that, my collaring ceremony to God.
I'd like to know how that transpires.
And what does that mean to you?
Thank you for asking. You know, since I was a little girl, I've always been deeply spiritual. And I believe that some of us, many of us, actually have the signs of the shaman. But we're not raised in a culture that says, oh, here's a little shaman. We want to take this person aside and make sure that they're trained. In our culture, I believe that many of us who have these signs of the shaman grow up to be sometimes the rebels, sometimes feeling very alone, sometimes turning to addictions because we're so overwhelmed by energy and information. And so the signs of the shaman that I had and that many of us will have, I think that might even be listening to this, is one is we're often very empathic. We feel emotions. We feel energy. We can find it very overwhelming. We can often feel we have is to be a very strong dreamer, someone who remembers their dreams in the morning, may remember dreams all the way back to childhood, and or someone who has very strong waking visions around what is possible, the inventor, the creator. Another sign of the shaman that you may have is often a very strong relationship to at least one element, earth, air, fire, or water. And when I say strong relationship, we feel at home with that element. We almost feel that that element communicates to us. When we're interacting with that element, we feel like we are in the realm of spirit or in a state of trance. Another sign of the shaman is often to have a very strong relationship with some type of animal. It could be, and that could be a bird, that could be a spider, but to often have something in our past and in our childhood where spiders were always in my room and wanted to communicate with me, or the rabbits in my neighborhood always followed me around, or, you know, something that is unusual in terms of how that being interacts with us. I had these signs of the shaman. When I was little, I would make altars and I would do little rituals. I didn't know what I was doing. I would try anyway. And I would go into trance. I ended up finding out later that I was doing certain shamanic things that no one taught me. And at 12, I also created my own coven. This was at a time period where there weren't really books on any of this. And I just really made this up and started doing rituals that worked. Became very frightened and told my mother, and she took me to the priest to exorcise me.
Oh, gosh.
Wow.
It was a big deal at the time. And so when I look back, there's this deep, deep part of me that wanted to be in right relationship with God, whether we say God, goddess, the divine, all that is, higher consciousness, however we want to name that. There's always been something in me that was called to be in right relationship with it, and even briefly considered being a nun because of this devotion that I had. And when I was in a master-slave relationship for approximately 4 years, and one of the things that I saw in it was a potential for beauty that was never quite actualized. And as I really started to unpack this and say, is what I want even possible from a human being? You know, I wanted my master to interact with me in a certain way. I wanted him to represent the divine to me. I wanted him to be wise and kind and in some ways understand me better than I understood myself. I wanted him to be an incredibly intuitive guide for my life. I wanted him to be totally trustworthy. And there were glimpses of something, you know, in certain scenes, in certain moments, there was glimpses of something truly beautiful and transcendent. But because, you know, he's a human being and he would have down days and bad moods and the ways that his own life had caused wounding and limitations in his psyche, there were also challenges, very deep challenges that arose in our relationship. And yet when we finally said, okay, the contract is null and void, and, you know, I'm taking off the collar, I felt so bereft. I felt like something was so lost, and I would have this longing for this sense of container, and I would have this longing for this sense of devotion that I wanted to give. I think that I already have that kind of devotional relationship with the divine. And when I feel that, you know, the goddess, the voice to me does feel feminine when I hear it. When I hear the goddess saying to me, Francesca, go here, do this, talk to this person, walk down the street this new way, create a ritual in this manner. I literally will hear a voice in my head. When this happens, I don't doubt it. And I walk down that street a new way, or I talk to a person I've never met, or I create a ceremony that's never existed. And I said, oh, wait, I am in devotion to something. I am already following something. I am already in a contract with something. I have a soul contract. It's already here. But the challenges I had with my former master is that, you know, he was imperfect. And
as humans tend to be.
As humans tend to be. And so he would ask me to do something and I would think, that doesn't make sense. Or that's not a good idea. Or that's not going to be healthy for me. But when the divine says, go do this, I don't question. I follow. And when I thought about that to myself, it just felt right. It felt so right to honor that relationship that I've actually been living for 30 years. I became an initiated priestess 30 years almost to the day. And so this is going to be the anniversary of 30 years.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It feels so right, and to celebrate it with my community, to come out, to acknowledge that this kind of relationship exists. You know, in the Catholic Church, you know, we say that we can have a ceremony that says that we're the bride of Christ and that we are in this very devoted and committed relationship, in that case to Christ. But for me, it's not about Christ. In some way, it's beyond name. I may use a name in the ceremony, but it's actually beyond name. It's to that deep, deep, deep river. Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who's a Jungian psychotherapist, calls it el río bajo el río, the river beneath the river of soul, the river of spirit.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You're describing the river of spirit.
So you're welcome. You're welcome to come join me. It'll be Sunday, July 12th out here in California.
Congratulations on this event that they're planning, this union that you're going to formalize. Interesting. Will you be posting more information about this on FetLife?
I will be posting more information.
You're a very interesting woman, priestess. I'm really, really glad that we got a chance to speak today. It's wonderful that you found time in your busy world to carve out a little bit to share with us. You do so many things. Again, thank you. And I hope that our listeners are going to be expanding their minds a little bit and thinking about sacred kink and a sacred sexuality and how it intertwines in their life and embrace all of the aspects of themselves and not live a fragmented existence. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Yes, thank you. We've really enjoyed speaking with you. I know we've wanted to do this for a long time now, and we did finally manage to get together with you, and it was awesome. You are extremely interesting, and you have a lot going on. And maybe we can get together and do this again. When you were talking about rituals, real quick, this past weekend, I was witness to a Kavadi-style flesh hook ritual and a modern blood ritual. You know, I was able to be a part of that when you were talking about being in the circle and, you know, people being involved and what was going on. Kind of like going to church. But it really, I mean, I was in tears. Just, I don't think there was a dry eye in the house. There was just so much energy, so much emotion going on, and totally awesome. I plan on doing some more research myself, and so I'm glad that we were able to connect at this time. All things happen for a reason.
When they're supposed to happen, yeah. Don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things that I also wanted to mention that you were mentioning integration is that when I first started leading the Kinky Spirituality Munch, people said that they felt very disintegrated, that they had a spiritual path and they had their kinky play and they were separate. And they were so excited to be able to, you know, start to look at how do I put these two things together? Can I put them together? How would I put them together? If I'm Christian and kinky, is there a way to, you know, pray to Jesus by, you know, being flogged?
Yes.
You know, and yes, there is. If I'm Buddhist, is there a way to be on the cross or be tied up or be in a hook pull in a way that supports my meditation? Yes. If I'm pagan, is there a way to utilize these toys and tools and techniques in pagan ceremony? Yes. And so they're absolutely integratable. And I think the really delicious thing for me about integrating them, not only it just feels good, I like integration. I personally, it doesn't feel good in my body when I feel disintegrated, when I feel that this part of me I can only show to these people. This part of me I can only talk about with these people. And I should probably out myself by saying that I used to be a card-carrying codependent and people pleaser. And I literally did that. I was the consummate chameleon. And if I was in front of you and you said that you like mayonnaise, I'd say, oh, mayonnaise, mayonnaise is so smooth and creamy and delicious and it cooks everything. And then if I was in front of someone else and they said, I hate mayonnaise, I'd say, oh, I hate mayonnaise. It's so slimy and it's oogy and it's just really disgusting. And I was constantly, you know, kind of morphing my opinions to match the people that were around me. And I eventually lost my own opinions and I didn't know what I thought. It was frightening to wake up one day and realize I literally didn't know who I was and what I thought.
When you lose yourself like that, it is frightening, isn't it?
Oh my God. And so then there was this, you know, work, really years of excavating and slowing down and saying, you know, what do I really want? And that could be from, you know, do I really like mayonnaise or don't I like mayonnaise? I mean, something so simple, but it, you know, there's always another layer. Do I like this kind of touch or not? Do I like this kind of sensation or not? Do I like this kind of pacing into sensation or not? And one of the things I saw in being a slave and a submissive is that tendency to codependency came out again. And I started to want to please my master so much that I started to disconnect from what was authentic for me. Which ultimately always backfires. But on the road to who am I truly, deeply, authentically, you know, there were some years in there where I was maybe very rebellious or maybe very in your face. There was also years in there where I felt split, you know, like I was leading a split life. So I was starting to find out who I was, but afraid that certain people wouldn't like it. And all of that was very painful. Today, I live a very integrated life where I love myself. I love myself when I make mistakes. I love myself when I am brilliant. I hold a loving container for my perfectly imperfect humanity. I come out in a graceful way. I don't come out as a rebel. I'm no longer like in your face. This is who I am. But neither am I hiding. I try to be appropriate and articulate for the community that I'm speaking to. And it feels so good to have that integration. And I'm saying this because I want to say it's possible and that it's okay to be wherever you are. I know that some of my students, some of my friends, they are teachers or something where they're really deeply afraid that if they came out, they would lose their jobs. And I understand that. And I wouldn't say come out, even though it means you're going to lose your job. And sometimes you may say it's worth it. It's worth it to come out. You know, when gay people have come out, you know, as the forerunners of saying it's worth it to say that I'm gay, even if I lose something, because it's important to start to raise awareness that the person next to you is gay. The person that, you know, you always liked or bought your, you know, meat from is gay. And I think that at some point, the kink world needs to do the same, where people really need to come out in a way en masse and really show that we're the average human being and we're everywhere. And it doesn't mean that we're going to hurt your children. It doesn't mean we're going to do anything terrible to anyone. It just is another flavor, another palette of sensation and human exploration that is done in a consensual, collaborative manner. You know, I just want to say that integration is possible wherever you are on the journey is the right place for you. The more that you can support yourself to come out, I find for myself when I've done that, I feel more whole. I feel more at peace. And I will say that at times I have lost. I've been kicked out of pagan organizations for coming out as teaching sacred kink. And even though that was painful, I'm glad I did. I still feel that it was the best choice, but I would not, of course, make that choice for another person. I want us to hold that as possible, that integration is possible, whether it's in this lifetime or not, it's possible.
I'm all for integration. It takes a lot of work to figure out exactly what those parts are and how to piece them together.
I think we're coming to another topic that's near and dear to my heart, which is therapeutic kink or even shamanic kink. And when I think of therapeutic kink or shamanic kink, I think of the tools and techniques of BDSM that are now being used specifically with the intention toward wholeness. That the person in front of me, if I consider myself a priestess dom, has identified that some part of themselves is missing. Some part of their soul, their psyche, was lost or hidden or rejected or denied or shamed. They've identified that there is some disintegration or there is some emotional wounding. And there's a concept in shamanism called soul retrieval. And there's a concept in trauma called disassociation. And when I put these two together, what I see is, the shamans were the original psychotherapists.
And they used natural pharmaceuticals.
And they did. When human beings experience trauma or abuse, it's very common for part of our psyche to hide or to split off. We literally did that when we were 5 or 7 or 8 or 10 or, 16, whenever that thing happened, to survive them. It was brilliant at the time because it allowed us to survive. But now when we're in our 20s or 30s or 40s or 50s or beyond, we can notice a sense of dis-ease or depression or numbness. We can notice we're blocked in how much we can trust people or how intimate we can let ourselves be. And when we notice that, when I notice that there's some way that I start to get numb in my intimate encounters, or there's some way that I start to almost sabotage my relationships, or there's some way that I'm noticing that I'm keeping everybody at a distance, or there's some way that I'm noticing I fall into depression over and over again, or anxiety over and over again. When I notice those things in myself, I say, it's time for me to go spelunking. And spelunking is cave dwelling, going into the cave, and to really go looking for those parts of myself that got put away or hidden or got shamed or split off in some way, and to bring them home. And I think that that's where we say it really is good to work with another person. I personally prefer working with a shaman or a psychotherapist or someone who does therapeutic kink or a pagan priest or priestess or a somatic therapist, someone who can, with or without medicine plants, really support and guide that journey. Because there's a point when I'm trying to reclaim part of myself that was lost, it might be scary for a moment. I remember a woman that I worked with who kept dreaming that she was a murderer. She said for years, she would dream that she would be strangling someone or stabbing them or shooting them. And most of the time she was male-bodied in the dreams, but occasionally she was female-bodied. And they were so vivid, and the blood would be on her hands. And she was terrified that in another life she had been a murderer. She was terrified that maybe this was a sign that she was going to murder someone. And when I worked with her and I supported her to go into a trance state, we went in that shamanic realm, in that hypnosis realm, we went to find the murderer. I had also talked with her prior to that about her life. I had done an intake. So I knew that the intake that I do covers questions around emotional abuse and trauma, sexual abuse and trauma, physical abuse and trauma, and spiritual abuse and trauma. And so I knew some background, and I knew that she had started to be molested around the time she was 5 years old. So we're going to find this murderer. And when we find him, he looks very scary and rough and gruff. And I thank him for showing up, for arriving. And I ask him, how long has he been part of her life? I was open. Maybe he would have said for many lifetimes. Maybe, I don't know what he was going to say. And what he said was, since she was a little girl. And I put two and two together and I said, did you kill the little girl in order to keep her safe? And I love, fairy tale and myth, because fairy tale and myth really is a map of the soul's journey in so many ways. when we have Sleeping Beauty or when we have Snow White. It really is that sign of when the young girl is traumatized and a part of her needs to go to sleep, a part of her needs to die, and that she's waiting to be awoken again. So when I was saying, you know, did you kill the little girl? I was almost like literally seeing in my mind, like, you know, the almost like Sleeping Beauty or Snow White. And he said, yeah, that he killed a little girl to keep this woman safe. And I said, do you know where you put her, this little girl? And he said, yes. And then I talked to the woman and I said, you know, I'm going to invite you to look at your life today. I think she was in her maybe mid to late 30s. I said, I'm going to invite you to look at your life today and ask yourself in a very deep way, is your life safe enough to bring the little girl back to life? Have you created that? Have you created a life that is safe enough? And she said, yes. And I said, do you feel ready to go find the little girl? And she said, yes. So we had the killer go find the little girl. We did a ritual in this shamanic state to bring the little girl back to life and bring her home to this woman, to bring her home to the body, to bring her home to the psyche. And when we looked at the killer again, the killer had transformed. And he looked, you know, more like Mr. Rogers or something. You know, he had like nice slacks and a little sweater and glasses. And his role as killer had actually been completed. And now he could be more of a guide. You know, she was able to come home to herself. When I think shamanic kink or therapeutic kink, that's when I'm working with people with that kind of intention. What are we going to bring home? What are we going to allow or invite? What are we going to release? And I worked with a client who flew in to see me who had been shamed by wearing his mother's lingerie when he was a little boy. You know, he got found out, he got shamed. We did a role play where I asked him in advance, do you want me to be the shaming mother, you know, the angry mother that, you know, how dare you, how could you, and really support you to find your own inner strength where you get to, you know, yell at me or yell back at me. Or I could be the nurturing mother. You know, when you find the lingerie and try it on, gives you an experience that you always long to have, which is to be approved of. He said he wanted the nurturing mother. So I, you know, dressed in 1950s kind of mom. I had, you know, lingerie in his size. We went into the space. He embodied this little boy and I embodied the mother. And I walked in on him, you know, where he was trying on the lingerie and said, oh, look, how cute you look. You know, it makes so much sense that you would be exploring mama's lingerie because you've always been such a sensual child. I remember when you were just like learning to walk and you loved the feel of silk. I used to take my silk scarves, you know, you'd be, you know, just laying down in your, sometimes even in your playpen, and I would, you know, trail the silk scarf over your belly and you would laugh and you've just all been so sensual. So no wonder you would want to, you know, explore this. And then he said, oh, you know, can I try it on? And I said, sure, sweetie, you know, go ahead. You know, I could even get some for you. You know, would you like some? This could be, you know, something that you could have for yourself. As long as you don't have to change at school, you know, you could even wear it underneath your clothes as something that, you know, has you feel good. We were at one point, we were laying fully dressed and he was wearing my lingerie and we were laying, you know, kind of cuddling in bed together. And I had this insight and I said, do you have a little girl inside you? And he had not spoken to me about this at all. And he said, in that moment, he said, yes, I do. I said, what's her name? And he said, Brenda. And I said, I'm the luckiest mom in the whole world. I get a little boy and a little girl. You know, he told me later that it just felt so healing to him, that he felt, you know, more alive, that he felt more whole because we were able to go through that. You know, he was able to go through that with me and actually start to rewrite and reprogram these terrible memories into something beautiful. You know, because some of us have never seen what a healthy relationship looks like. We have never seen it. We have never seen what it looks like to be kindly approved of by our parents, being different. I mean, we've never seen it. We've never seen what it is to have someone set, you know, speak a very compassionate boundary. Like, oh, honey, you know, can I get you your own stockings? Mama's a little bit nervous that you might hurt mine, but I'm happy to get you yours. A compassionate boundary. Instead of saying, what are you doing? You know, being in my things, and how could you? And shame, 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 shame.
Right, bringing up the shame, and those feelings permeate a person's psyche.
Forever.
Yeah, forever.
And this is important for those who are listening. I've done a lot of research with this, and what I've read everywhere and what I've experienced is we do not just get over these woundings. We leave the house. You know, in our 20s is normally, you know, our teens and 20s, we're like, I'm free. I'm out of the house. I'm, you know, I'm away from those parents or that neighborhood or those teachers, or, you know, I'm finally free. But these wounds, these emotional wounds are still with us. And as we try to go into more deeper and committed relationships that feel like family, the word familiar and the word family have the same root. As we go into these deeper committed relationships, our fears, our tears, our owie places start to arrive. We start to become very sensitive. We start to become very scared. We start to be triggered. And it's really because we're longing for healing. And if we don't know that it's normal to have these things arrive in a relationship, but that I'm responsible for my healing. You are not responsible for my healing if we're dating. I'm responsible for my healing. When I start to be really sensitive, when I start to be really triggered, I can ask for your collaboration, but I have to be in charge of the healing process. And, you know, really, maybe I should go work with a therapeutic kink person or a somatic therapist or, yes, or someone else, because it might be a lot to put on you. But thank you for being close enough to me that these core issues have started to arrive for the purpose of healing. Because, you know, if they're not up, if when everything's buried, I can't really heal it. It's really when it's up, when it's arisen, when it's activated.
It takes a tremendous amount of courage to face that and push forward when you recognize it. What you're saying is very true. They stay buried and hidden until something, as you said, familiar, brings them back up, and then you're forced to deal with it, right?
I would say you have a choice. What I see all too often is trying to leave. Do you know what I mean? It's, oh, you're the problem. I'll date someone else. Oh, look, now another person who feels really critical and abusive, I'll leave them. Oh, now I'm ended up with another person who feels critical, abusive. I'll leave them. And, you know, without recognizing that there's some way that I'm either calling this into my life.
Right.
B, I may be even seeing it where it doesn't exist. I've been in situations where I was at something the other day where a group of us were all sharing, and one of the people in the meeting started to say, you're all against me. You know, you're all against me. You're not listening. You're invalidating me. And we all kind of looked around at each other in the circle, you know, kind of looking and thinking, what? You know, what? And we tried to say to this person, you're important. We want to hear you. We think what you have to say is valid. Your point of view gets to be really sacred. We may or may not agree with it, but it gets to be valuable and sacred as your point of view. And this person kept just saying, no, no, you're making me a victim. No, I'm not safe. And there was a point where it was so sad because they couldn't see. They literally couldn't see that we were right there in front of them saying, we like you, we see you, we want to encourage you, you get to be included. And they literally couldn't take it in. So we have to be careful when we go into these triggers, because we're no longer hearing the present. We're actually hearing the past. I would definitely say, if you feel like you're in a loop, like I'm always in groups that, you know, dislike me, or I'm always in relationships that criticize me. If you're starting to feel like there's a consistency, we are the common denominator of our lives. And when I see that consistency in myself, I say, oh, it's time for me to get therapy or, you know, to do something, because I'm not, there's some way that I'm either not seeing what's really here or I'm calling this into my life.
Yes, being stuck in a loop is a frightening thing if you don't understand what's happening.
Right. And it's interesting too, because when we've had this kind of trauma in our lives, often part of our healing process is learning to speak up and advocate for our limits and boundaries. You know, that is part of the healing journey.
Yes.
So, and it can get a little foggy, which is why I also recommend working with somebody else. And this could be a mentor. It could be a mentor in the scene as well, or going into 12-step if you have an addiction. Like, you know, I had addictions that I recovered from, so I also had sponsors in 12-step program. You know, to have somebody who's a sounding board.
Yeah.
When I'm going through things and I'm explaining that the person could say, ah, priestess, this is a time that it would be very healthy for you to advocate for your limit or boundary.
You have to be willing to hear that as well. If you're not ready to hear it, your friends can tell you, you know, you're walking down the wrong path 100 times until you're ready to see it yourself, that it's not going to help until you're absolutely ready.
These things do not heal by themselves. We absolutely need to get support, conscious support. And that's, you're absolutely right when you say, you know, nobody else can force us. You know, we could have 10 friends trying to do an intervention saying, priestess, priestess, you're in a dysfunctional relationship, or priestess, you're delusional. You know, I could have 10 people telling me this. And if I'm not ready, no one can make me. And that's why for all of us that are listening, I hope that we are each committed to our own personal growth and are ongoingly seeking a collaboration and support and feedback and sounding boards so that we can see our blind spots, so we can continue to come into greater and greater wholeness and to understand that those terrible things that happened are still like splinters that got lodged in our system. And until we actually work to kind of dig in there and get them back out in ways that we're not even completely aware of, they're going to pop up, you know, be hurtful to ourselves or hurt those around us.
With that, we're going to have to end this podcast. We have a lot to work with, and it was absolutely wonderful talking to you. Hope to do it again soon. So I really do thank you again for speaking with us tonight.
It's my pleasure. I'm so glad. I've been wanting to for a long time, and you're both completely delightful. Mwah.
You have been listening to episode 72 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week when we have Singing Phoenix speaking of slavery.